I'm Gina Kaufman, and here with me now is Sherry Tucker. She's an American Studies professor at KU, and she's recently published a book called Dance Floor Democracy: The Social Geography of Memory at the Hollywood Canteen. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me this morning.
Thanks for being here. What was the Hollywood Canteen? Set the scene for us.
Well, yeah, I'm happy to do that. The Hollywood Canteen was a nightclub. It was during World War II, 1942 to 1945. It was on the corner, if you know Los Angeles, it was the corner of Sunset and Cahuenga, and it was a place where civilians entertained soldiers, sailors, and Marines who were in Los Angeles. But it's more than that. It's like I was listening to the high school segments. It's more than that because it's kind of like the golden age for many people. It's a golden age for the nation in some ways, in that there's a lot of nostalgia around a club like that. And like high school, there are also a lot of different experiences and a lot of different ways of remembering that site.
Well, we're going to talk a lot about that, but this was the swing era, no?
That's right. Well, it's what we call the late swing era, because the swing era is earlier, starts much earlier. It's in the 1930s, in fact, the mid-1930s, the swing era becomes a mass culture, really, in some ways, the first mass culture in America. But before that, it's an African-American music and dance culture. It becomes very mainstream. Late swing era in the 1940s is when it's very mainstream and also becomes the symbol of the nation, becomes the music that's associated with World War II.
Tell me about the music and the dancing, the aesthetic, the personality, and to the extent that there is a mass cultural movement behind it, what that was about.
Well, you know, it's a complicated story. My research is oral history, so I'm interested in how many different people remember that. But it also makes it very difficult to answer a question.
Because you want to give me all these different answers.
Right. Which was, you know, it was one of the challenges of writing the book, because I could give a general answer, but I'm going to start interrupting myself because I'm going to remember people who remember it differently. So, I could answer it two ways. One, to say that it shows up, like if you look at like World War II reenactments or reunions or things like that, when we have anniversaries of World War II, the shows that travel are these nostalgia shows that show swing music, people jitterbugging, oftentimes people dressed as a civilian woman and a military man doing the jitterbug. So there's that, but then there's also when you're really doing the jitterbug, when you're really dancing, people are not having exactly the same experience. And there's a communication. It's a couple dance that's quite interesting in that there are moments of improvisation and moments of being together, but that there's a communication in the hand clasp, so that if you're doing it well, both people who are doing it have some impact. But it's also possible to do it in which the stronger of the two people is yanking the other person around. So there could be different experiences going on.
Yeah, visually, I picture kind of like big flowy skirts and like twirling around and people coming together and apart a lot, and kind of like, you know, like when you're a kid and you hold someone's hands and you both pull back.
Yes.
And it looks like maybe you're going to fall apart, but you just sort of don't magically while you're spinning around. A little like that.
Yes, exactly. Or you do fall. You do fall down.
Sometimes you fall down.
But that's it. And that's that is exactly the kind of tension and possibility that excites me about the jitterbug and about the swing era as a symbol for democracy.
Yeah, you have, as you've stated, people usually think of this place you studied, the Hollywood Canteen, as a patriotic gathering place on the home front, and it's wrapped up in a lot of nostalgia for what's often called the greatest generation. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that nostalgia?
Well, there's a lot of people have written about this, and it's something that I don't even think I knew I was going to be writing about when I did this book, but there is a kind of nostalgia. There's a look and feel of swing dancing during World War II that comes back again and again and again, and oftentimes at moments when the U.S. is about ready to be involved in war mobilization, and so, or you know, explicitly naming something as war. So
what made you want to study what was going on sociologically on the dance floor?
I wanted to talk about the dance floor because I was I had come from another swing project. My first book was on all-woman jazz and swing bands of the 1940s. I was interested in the 40s initially because it's a time when some of those rules about race and gender and class are sort of thrown in the air a little bit. Sexuality. I mean, it's this window of time when things, people are moving around, things are changing a little bit. There's a moment of possibility. I was interested in that. But after talking to the women in the all-woman bands who had really different view of that time period than any of the books written about, you know, big bands of that time period, it really made me want to move to the dance floor. And it made me realize how jazz scholars such as myself, so many of us have talked about the music as though it's all sound and that there's nothing else going on in the sites where it's happening. So I wanted to interview dancers. Because this club was in Hollywood and it was part of the nostalgia about the Hollywood canteen is that these are not ordinary civilians. These are movie stars. In the memory, they're movie stars. In reality, they were lots of different people, most of whom belonged to the guilds and unions of the motion picture industry. And so I ended up interviewing a lot of secretaries and people who worked in different jobs. But it was also remembered nostalgically for being racially integrated. And I knew enough about that time period to know that if that happened in Hollywood, it wouldn't have happened in a simple way, because Hollywood itself was quite segregated. And you know, the troops were segregated, Red Cross blood supplies were segregated, everything was. So if it was integrated, how did that happen? And what did that feel like from different bodies on that dance floor?
So you start talking to different people about this and you're getting different perspectives. Can you give us maybe quickly two different perspectives that show that, you know, knowing that there isn't just one answer to what was going on here?
Absolutely. I interviewed one person who was a starlet, who was a white woman who was very, very proud of having danced with people of all races, and that was a very important part of her memory. And I asked her if she had any specific memories about it, and she said no, because it didn't matter to me. I didn't notice color. I danced with everybody, and that was what was so wonderful about the Hollywood canteen. And I interviewed another, one of my other interviewees was an African-American man who was in the Marines, and he said it was integrated in that I could enter the club. But I was led to a different part of the club where there were other African-American soldiers and there were no black hostesses, and I didn't feel that I could dance with anybody. And I went, and he said he went several times and the experience was always the same. So she says, it was integrated. I know it was integrated. I didn't even notice color. It didn't matter. And he's saying it was integrated, but not in an equal way.
How do these kind of different stories challenge not just our ideas about this dance club, but about this period in American history?
Well, I think it gets us to think, it gets me to think more about how the ways that we have of talking about that time of history are really not helpful.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that there's kind of two ways of talking about it. One could tell a greatest generation good war story in which this was a really special time in American culture, you know, where people really came together, and that it's a moment to really think about as a hopeful time. Or you can debunk that, and there's a lot of work that debunks that, that can say, actually, no, you know, it was a lot of people were not treated fairly. There was, you know, you could talk about all of the other things that are going on. My challenge, I wanted to find a way of thinking about those both of those things together, because I think that's what we still have. I think that's what the legacy is that we still have a room where somebody's having a good time and somebody's having a bad time. And we still have this kind of like, there's only one way to talk about it. It's great or it's terrible. And there has to be
and
a
people
way.
People debate whose reality is correct.
Exactly. Exactly. We still have this like one we has to bubble up from the crowd to represent everybody. And it makes it impossible at that point to hear, you know, to feel that pull in the hand clasp if somebody is, you know, trying to pull the other way or trying to say, you know, my body isn't having a good time.
And so the 1940s and the dance hall in particular, you see that as maybe an origin point for this thing that keeps happening even today. Like if you listen to the news, there are people debating things that they're just experiencing the world so differently.
I don't think it's an origin point. I think that that's probably, I think that what it is, it's a moment. It's a moment that's still very powerful in my present, that I still see it happening. And there's a kind of smooth picture that I wanted to get at, you know, what is that smooth picture that keeps coming back? And how can, it was really the last opportunity I felt to interview members of that generation. And the stories I got from members of that generation wasn't, we were all unified, we were all the same. Some people said that, and other people didn't. And a lot of people from the generation that's been called the greatest generation were quite critical of that, of being cast as a greatest generation, a unified generation. A lot of people I interviewed were critical that there are still wars. There, a lot of people spoke to me as though I had bought the nostalgia. Even though I actually was trying to critique it, but they would want to explain to me what was wrong with it. So I felt it was more respectful to listen to members of the generation while I could, and to listen to people who had danced on this very nostalgic site, that could help us think differently about that time, about the nostalgia, and about the present.
Is there someone you interviewed who has a story that you think does tell a larger story that hasn't been heard before?
Oh, there were so many. There are so many. I would let me see. The military women. That was interesting. Military women were allowed in the Hollywood canteen, but most of the military women I talked to remembered being not allowed to dance, not allowed to eat, being sent to the mezzanine where they could watch the civilian women and the military men dance. And some of the military women were quite angry about it.
What did they say was the explanation for that policy?
We already have hostesses.
Oh, so the idea that there were two different kinds of women.
Right.
Interesting.
Right. There was no that the category military woman was impossible, because either they're military or they're women, and if they're women, they're there to serve the military, but to be a military woman. You see that too. I mean, even in the debates over whether or not to have the women's branches, which are going on during World War II, prior to World War II, there had been women in the military in World War I. That was then very discontinued and had to be reinvented again. So it's already controversial. So I think one of the stories might be one of the women who told me about. Her response to that was to march right out of there and to glare at the movie stars on her way out. So I love that, because the movie stars are important in her story of that, of her, what her body, what it felt like to be in her body in that space. But they are, she's glaring at them while she marches out the door.
And that's, did she feel that the message had been received?
Oh, no, I don't think so. But I think, you know, telling the story, this is what I like about oral history, is that the narratives that we can come up with to explain ourselves in the past are also ways of explaining ourselves in the present and making that make sense.
Yeah, so, that jumping off point into the future is I walked out the door.
I walked out the door.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was.
You know, are you a music fan yourself?
Yes.
For a lot of people, love of this kind of music comes with the nostalgia and the nostalgia for the other stuff that surrounded it, the style, the mood. Does hearing stories of inequality at this time and in these contexts sour you on the music at all?
No, it doesn't sour me on the music at all. I mean, I think I've interviewed a lot of musicians from that time period, too. And I think most of my most of the musician interviews that I've done would also tell different kinds of stories about that time period. I know people love this music. I love the music, but I don't. I think I know enough about the history of the music and the segregation in particular, what it meant to go on the road, or what it meant to who had access to which jobs, which is not something that even most of the white musicians I've talked to are happy about or comfortable with. So it's, I would say musicians tend to talk about, try to tell music fans about aspects of the music that fans don't necessarily know about.
Are we in the process today of forming certain ideas about pop culture that you suspect the American studies professors of the future are just going to have a heyday with?
That's really funny. Well, the American studies professors of the present, some of us try to keep up with what's going on and try to keep doing that. I mean, it's a wonderful way of, for me, I like to ask students to bring in the music that they think is where the debates of the day are happening, and we listen and we talk about it, and it's a great way into to discussing that.
What are some of the things your students are bringing in?
What are they bringing in? They're bringing in, See, I'm showing that my memory, I hope none of my students who brought me cool music are listening.
I'm not remembering the names of anybody.
But they're bringing in interesting genres I haven't heard about, that I can't think of the names of, but very kind of, a lot of the stuff that sounds to me very kind of ambient, I guess. And I understand now ambient. Well, I know this. I'm playing that I'm more naive than I am. I know that ambient is now a genre. It's a genre. But what I mean is more that it just sounds like mood music. But it's, so that's, I don't know what's going on there.
Well, that is the problem for the American studies professor of the future.
But that's right.
That's all the time we have for today. Sherry Tucker has joined us from KU's Department of American Studies. Her book is called Dance Floor Democracy. Thanks so much for being here, Sherry.
Thank you, Gina. It's been a pleasure.
To listen back to any of the conversations you've heard today on our show, go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. Tomorrow, the food critics will be here with notes on the use of fresh herbs for all things culinary. We'll hear about appetizers, entrees, salads, desserts, and cocktails that have gone herbal. Tune in for that tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.